I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. When Rock Around the Clock was released in 1954, it was a forgettable dud. But a year later, it became a smash hit. Jackson was the most popular baby name for boys in 2017. Why did Ava come in fourth, behind Sophia, Olivia, and Emma for girls? My guest today has written a book about why some things break through the miasma of pop culture to become fixtures in our common discourse, while others, oh so many others, fade into oblivion. Today on this archive edition of Midday, Derek Thompson joins me to talk about hitmakers, the science of popularity in an age of distraction. Our show has been pre-recorded, so we can't take your calls or emails. The science of popularity, when Midday starts right after the news. Ah, yes, for anyone, and that means pretty much everyone, who has ever carried her lunch tray from the food line into the vast expanse that is the high school cafeteria, the dread that accompanies the problem of where to sit and who to sit with is painfully familiar. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. My guest today has studied the science of popularity. Not the popularity of certain people necessarily, but what products, what TV networks, what movies and apps and songs succeed while others do not. He notes that as consumers, we are at once neophilic, interested in discovering something new, as well as neophobic, afraid of things that are unfamiliar. And he observes that the things that do work, the stuff that, for whatever reason, hits a chord and resonates with lots of people over long periods of time, that stuff works because it is, in his phrase, surprisingly familiar. Derek Thompson is a senior editor at Atlantic Magazine and the host of the podcast Crazy Genius. He has written a fascinating book about why certain things are cool, at least for a while, and he explores whether or not there are commonalities between them across creative and cultural disciplines. The book is called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Derek Thompson joins me from the studios of NPR in New York. How you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
This book is terrific. I really enjoyed it. I've had it on my bedside table for a long time, and I'm glad that we finally have a chance to talk about it. At one point, you write that people are mysterious and markets are chaos. Is it any surprise that most creativity is failure? And I couldn't agree more that people do seem mysterious and markets do seem very chaotic. But you do your best, I think, in this book to take some of that mystery out of the equation. Is that what your aspiration was?
I couldn't imagine a better summary of my aspiration for this book. I think that popularity is inherently fascinating. When something comes out of nowhere to become a national sensation, a global sensation, whether it's a song or a movie or a politician or an idea, I mean, how can you not wonder where did that thing come from and what's the story of its journey from obscurity to popularity? So what I wanted to do was essentially to write a book that tried to answer that question with both storytelling from cultural history and political history and the history of ideas, but then also to marry those stories with some science from psychology and sociology and even economics so that we could get as close as possible to coming up with a blueprint for understanding popularity and even for engineering it.
And I was fascinated by one of the examples you gave, which is the example of choosing a first name for a baby, because the supply of names is basically infinite. It doesn't cost anything. And you can just sort of go any which way you feel like. I wonder, does that process of choosing baby names that young parents are doing every day, does that supply in any way a paradigm for other things, for anything else?
Oh, absolutely. My chapter about the history of baby name popularity is maybe my favorite chapter in the book. Probably my first or second favorite. And it was such a joy to explore and such a joy to write about. So basically, the reason to care about first names, other than, you know, giving your baby son or daughter the perfect first name, is that, you know, for when you think about fashion, and you think about the idea that some fashions come and go, fashion is a really weird thing because the architecture of the human brain is really, really ancient. Our preference for familiarity, for example, is extremely ancient. So why should fashions even exist? You know, why should something like bell bottoms become popular, then unpopular, and then kind of become popular again if our brains really aren't changing? And so first names are a really, really good place to investigate fashion, because in most marketplaces, you could say, well, fashion is just about marketing. Fashion is just about economics. Fashion is just about prices and scarcity. But look, there is a marketplace where there's no marketing, where everything costs the same, and where we're all shopping from the same infinity store. And that marketplace is the marketplace of first names. All first names cost $0. No company is trying to get us to name our kid Nike. It's a great laboratory to investigate this mystery of why does fashion happen? And the reason is that most of us have a preference for ideas that, as you explained very well at the top of the show, are familiar surprises. We recoil from things that are too new, but also recoil from things that feel overly familiar. So what tends to happen is that in the early 1990s, a handful of parents will say, you know, a perfect familiar surprise for a name is a name like Samantha. It's maybe the 30th, 40th, 50th most popular name in the country in the early 1990s. So a bunch of parents, or 224,000 to be perfectly precise, say, Samantha's a perfect name for our girl in 1992. So Samantha jumps up and becomes the number two most popular name in America for baby girls in 1992. But then what happens? 5 years later, all those Samanthas get into kindergarten. The parents are horrified to realize that the snowflake name they chose, the individual, unique name they chose for their baby girl, is in fact broadly shared. And so their younger parents having children stop naming their daughter Samantha. They want a name that is its own familiar surprise. So even in a marketplace, without pricing, without marketing, you still have hype cycles, the same that you have in fashion. And that story, I think, goes so far toward explaining this sort of formula or blueprint for why we like what we like. And that is that we're constantly responding to stimuli and information from the world around us. We're constantly trying to find our own familiar surprises.
And the folks who are best at that, the creators who are best at that, are the ones who succeed. You give the example of the Brahms lullaby. People know this tune. Every baby has heard it, or many babies have heard it. And it was an instant success. Why do you think that was? What are the components of that song, that melody, of the millions of melodies that existed before and have existed after that one? What are the components that make it so compelling to so many people across cultures?
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful story of Brahms' lullaby. In many ways, I think you can make the argument that it might be the most heard song in the Western Hemisphere. If you think about the fact that no one listens to their favorite song 1,000 times. I mean, even if you love a certain Kanye song or a certain Beatles song, you probably aren't going to listen to it 1,000 times. But a song that you may hear 1,000 times in your lifetime is a lullaby. Every day, if your mother sings it to you for 3 years, that's 1,000 instances of hearing that song. So Brahms' lullaby is one of the most popular lullabies in the world, might be the most heard song in the Western Hemisphere. And I wanted to know why. It was the song that my mother sang to me when I fell asleep for not just 3 years, maybe 7 years, 8 years, 9 years. I've maybe heard it 10,000 times. My grandmother sung it to me in German. And the story of Brahms' lullaby is a perfect combination of the first principle we talked about, familiar surprise, plus another principle, which is distribution. So first, let's talk about It Is a Familiar Surprise. Johann Brahms, brilliant composer, was also a thief. He was like Picasso, you know? He thought that all great art had involved a little bit of stealing. So he would travel around Europe and visit libraries and look at sheet music of popular folk songs in those areas and kind of just swipe them, just steal the song. And that's what he did with this song. It was Brahms' Lullaby is based on a popular folk song from the Hamburg region. And he basically steals the melody, but he dresses it up as a beautiful orchestral piano piece. And it was instantly adored, I think, in many ways, because it was so familiar to its audience in Vienna. A lot of people listening in Vienna said, this is a beautifully dressed up version of a song that we already know. And it was an absolute instant hit. Sold so many copies of paper. Obviously, not vinyl did not exist in the middle of the 19th century, but of paper. And then the really interesting story is, how did it spread so far around the world? And here's where it gets awesomely cool. So in the 1880s and 1870s, when this song is sort of breaking out, you have the highest period of German emigration, people leaving Germany and traveling all over the world because you had all these terrible economic conditions in Germany. The settling of Germans in the U.S. in that swath of land from, say, Pennsylvania up through Wisconsin is happening in these 1870s and 90s. And a lot of people move to this part of the country, and they essentially take this song with them. So in fact, I went back through my own family records and I found that my great-great-grandfather left sort of modern Liechtenstein in the 1870s, traveled to Michigan in this sort of German emigration swath, and started his family. And you sort of follow that family tree down to my mom, and she sang this song to me. The entire story of the distribution of Brahms' Lullaby can be told through German emigration patterns. And so you have both elements here. Brahms' Lullaby as the perfect familiar surprise, but also this story of how did the product spread? How did it get to people? And in this case, the distribution technology was not radio, it was not the internet, it was not Facebook. It was immigration.
Yeah, and you talk about, you know, the trick being to frame any new ideas as kind of a tweak of an old one. And you use the terms fluency and disfluency. You say it's important for creators to mix a little bit of each. Define what you mean by those two concepts.
Sure. This is a popular concept among psychologists, and it refers to sort of a heady idea, which is that we have feelings about our thoughts. Now, that sounds totally convoluted at first, but think about it. You can sort of rank all of the thoughts that you have, all the impressions that you have of the world, along a spectrum of this is easy to think about, it's an easy rhyme, it's a familiar song, it's a lovely idea, versus this is hard to think about. This is me reading a foreign language. It's me listening to a music piece with a really weird time signature, right? So what psychologists would say is that a way to sort of name this spectrum is to say that our thoughts range between fluency, ease of thinking, and disfluency, difficulty of thinking. Now, for the most part, we like ideas that are fluent. We like songs that are familiar and easy to listen to. We like movies with stars and predictable storylines. We like political ideas that we've already decided are true. We are always on the hunt for fluency. But the really special thing that geniuses across the cultural landscape understand is that deep down, we kind of like disfluency too. We love a little bit of a challenge. We love, in fact, for fluency to emerge from disfluency. We love to be confused in the middle of an Agatha Christie book or a movie mystery or television procedural. We love to be confused and then have the problem resolved. We love to be reading a book where we don't know what's happening and we have all these questions and then the questions are answered. Disfluency yielding into fluency. And there's a lovely idea to summarize this whole concept, and it's called the aesthetic aha. That when we have these moments where we discover familiarity within surprise and mystery, that's an aha moment. That's the definition of a eureka. And in a way, I think the thing that consumers are hunting for across the cultural landscape are these aha moments. We want them not only from songs and movies and television shows, but from books and from articles and even from conversations. We love little mysteries to be raised, and then we love them to be resolved with answers that feel intuitive. And so fluency and disfluency is essentially a way of graphing the entire world of culture along a single spectrum.
Yeah, you're right that people sometimes don't know what they want until they already love it. And that's certainly an experience I've had. And we're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about a book that I definitely know I love. It's called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Derek Thompson is my guest. We'll have more with Mr. Thompson when we come back. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. To find us on Twitter, @MiddayWIPR. Don't go to sleep. Stay with us. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a conversation with First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams. He argued the Pentagon Papers case and the Citizens United case in front of the Supreme Court. We'll talk about his latest book, The Soul of the First Amendment. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're listening to the conversation I had in May with Derek Thompson, a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine and host of the Crazy Genius podcast. His book is called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Derek, talking about distribution again, I'm interested in the example you use of ESPN, the network ESPN. Because it is, according to your reckoning, the most valuable brand in all of media, and it accounts for half of the Walt Disney Company's annual profits, which is even more than its entire movie division. That's interesting. So why is that? Why is the model of ESPN so fabulously successful, at least for the moment?
Yeah, and this is an interesting story because this is sort of an example of how the thing about books is you can't change them even when history changes very quickly. So it is absolutely true that when I published this book, ESPN did account for half of the Walt Disney Company's profits. But the television industry is changing really quickly, and ESPN's share of Disney's profits are actually down to something closer like 35%. So I'm going to explain why that's happened even as I answer your question.
But that's still a chunk. That's still a pretty
still a
good
chunk.
Chunk.
And it's still more than the entire, it's still about 2 times more, I believe, than the entire movie division.
Mm-hmm.
So what's really interesting about cable television in general is that I think a lot of people don't realize how the economics of cable TV work. That the television networks that you are watching make their money not only from advertising, but also from what's called carriage or sometimes affiliate fees. And that means that every time you pay $100 in order to subscribe to cable, the cable company you're paying, Comcast, Spectrum, Cox, is paying about $40 to all of those television networks. ESPN has historically and still does receive the highest per month payment. Every single month that you are subscribing to cable television, you are paying $8 directly to ESPN. ESPN can do this. It can charge the highest amount of any network because most of its most valuable content is live. So you have to be watching it live to understand, you know, did the Rockets win? Did the Warriors win? Did the Yankees win? And so ESPN essentially has used the particular distribution economics of the television cable bundle in order to become the most valuable media brand in the world. It was a content play, yes, but it was also a distribution play. But the television business is changing really quickly. Half of all Americans between the age of 20 and 35 didn't watch any pay TV, that is traditional cable bundle television, last year. They're watching Netflix, they're watching HBO, they're watching Showtime, over the top, pure internet television. So a lot of young people are leaving the cable bundle and moving toward these other subscription channels. And that means that the distribution of content in television is totally changing. It's in the middle of just a seismic event. And so in order to make a show popular, you don't just have to answer the first question, which is, how do I make great content? How do I make something that moves people, that is filled with aha moments and is a true familiar surprise? You also have to answer the question, how do you reach the people who are most likely to love this? Do you reach them through the cable bundle, which is getting older and older in terms of its median age? Or do I go to find them in this vast savanna of over-the-top internet-only television options like Hulu and HBO and Showtime and Netflix and Amazon? It's becoming a much more difficult question to answer. How do you distribute the best content in television?
Yeah,
but it goes directly to your point.
Yeah, there's a piece in the Wall Street Journal today saying that since 2011, ESPN revenue down 16% because so fewer and fewer people are signing up for cable. I mean,
right.
Cable
and it's an old thing.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's important to remember, it's not because ESPN is worse, right? If you're the sort of person who thinks that distribution doesn't matter and all you have to do is just focus on making great things and never worry about their marketing and distribution, then if you read something like, oh, ESPN's profit is down 16%, your first conclusion will be, oh, that's because ESPN is worse, right? The product is worse. What they're doing, the quality of their work declined by 16% and their profits declined commensurately. But of course that's not true. That doesn't explain the story at all. The story is that ESPN is essentially, can only be accessed on a cable bundle, on a product that is much less popular among younger Americans. And that is why the product itself is suffering.
And sometimes the product is up and sometimes the product is down. One of the cases that you talk about is the instance of the famous rock song Rock Around the Clock, Bill Haley and the Comets. When it was first released in 1954, nobody paid attention. I mean, it was forgotten as soon as it was out there. But then it got attached, speaking of distribution, to another medium. It got attached to a movie, The Blackboard Jungle, just a year later in 1955, and it became this smash iconic thing. So it tastes don't even necessarily have to change. It's just sort of the packaging, I guess. I mean, it's the same song, right? And pretty much the same people between 1954 and 1955 who'd be interested in a pop song. It's a fascinating story.
It's a fascinating story, and the story is even weirder than that. What you told is a perfectly accurate story. It's basically about distribution, that when Rock Around the Clock, which I should say is the second best-selling song in the history of American music, when it came out in 1954, it was a dud. And when the exact same song came out not over the radio, but rather in movie theaters in 1955, it became the hit of the century. So that seems very much like a question or like a difference of distribution. But the story of Rock Around the Clock is also a story about unbelievable luck. Unbelievable luck. So it comes out, this song. It sells several thousand copies in vinyl. And it's basically destined to be forgotten. It's a B-side on a forgotten vinyl record. But one of the people who bought that record was a 12-year-old boy named Peter Ford. Now, Peter Ford was the son of a movie actor, Glenn Ford, who was the star of this film, Blackboard Jungle. And one day, the director of this film, Richard Brooks, comes over to the Ford's house in Los Angeles. And he says, you know, I'm making this movie, Blackboard Jungle. It's a movie about juvenile delinquency. I need a scary song to kick it off. Do you have any ideas for me, Glenn? And Glenn says, no, I don't, because my favorite kind of music is actually Hawaiian folk, and that's not very scary at all. But you should talk to my son, Peter Ford, because Peter likes a lot of this new rock and roll music. And Peter Ford, again, this fifth grader, hands the director, Richard Brooks, this pack or this stack of vinyl records, one of which includes the song Rock Around the Clock. And Richard Brooks likes the song so much that he puts it at the beginning of Blackboard Jungle, in the middle of Blackboard Jungle, and at the end of Blackboard Jungle. And it's only then, after Blackboard Jungle comes out, that the song becomes the number one song in the country, the first rock and roll song to ever hit number one, and the second best-selling song of all time. So if you're the sort of person who thinks that great content succeeds and bad content fails, and the only difference between the successful stuff and the unsuccessful stuff is just quality, You cannot explain the story of Rock Around the Clock. It's impossible. The
serendipity
songs gotta be
matters.
Exact
same. Absolutely.
Serendipity matters a lot.
Derek Thompson, his book is called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. To follow us on Twitter, @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. And of course, once a thing becomes popular, Derek, you write about how sometimes people buy it because it's popular. I mean, it's not maybe the best thing out there or the best option in whatever category they're looking for. But because it's popular, they are drawn to it. And then when it comes to things like music and movies, you talk a lot about the power of repeated exposure, this familiarity again. I wonder, in the case of Mr. Trump, our president, the fact that he had the kind of...
I'm always waiting for this question.
the kind of exposure that he had in the 2016 campaign was unprecedented. The CNN, breathless wall-to-wall coverage of every time he made an utterance just hadn't happened in American politics up until that juncture. Is repeated exposure one of the key animating factors behind Mr. Trump's success? I mean, or was it his message? Was it the way it was put out, the way it was distributed, the scale upon which it was distributed? To what do you attribute this really historic occasion where a guy who's brand new to politics, who has a message that everybody, including his own supporters, identify as divisive and often exclusionary, becomes the president of the United States?
Yeah, it's a great question. It is the inevitable question. And it is also the question that I answer at greater length in the preface to the paperback, which just came out. And I'll summarize the case there relatively briefly. Let me give two ways in which this book attempts to explain the phenomenon of Donald Trump without pretending that we are reaching any sort of, grand unified theory of Trumpiness. Explanation number one is that, just as you said, repetition breeds familiarity, and familiarity breeds liking. We tend to feel more comfortable with ideas and faces and stories that are familiar. And so among Republican primary voters, you should expect that a candidate that you see all the time is the candidate that you should end up liking, that you should feel more comfortable with. Now, this won't work, obviously, for someone who's a liberal. If you're, repeatedly exposed as a liberal to someone who is extremely illiberal, that's not going to make you like them anymore. It's just going to make you hate them more. But if you're already predisposed to the message, then seeing him on Trump, on television, over and over again is absolutely going to raise your affinity for him. So there is no question in my mind that CNN and other cable networks' decision to essentially turn their television station into Trump national news was a key factor in not only creating his popularity, but also sustaining it. The second, slightly more complicated thing to point out, however, is that Trump is the perfect familiar surprise. There is a theory in politics called the Law of 14, which says that no successful presidential candidate has won office more than 14 years away from his or her first year in a governor's mansion or in Congress. That's a complicated way of essentially saying we like relatively fresh faces. Trump was a relatively fresh face in politics. Obama was a relatively fresh face in politics. George W. Bush wasn't well known in Washington. We like relatively fresh faces to go into the White House. But what do we want to hear from those relative novelties? Make America Great Again is the definition of traditionalism. And in fact, it's so traditional, Ronald Reagan said it 28 years ago. Hope and change, Barack Obama's message, is basically two of the oldest cliches in the history of political sloganeering married to each other. So we have this preference for new faces telling us old stories in politics. And it turns out that is exactly what we want, not only from politics, but also from other cultural products. We love new products that are sneakily familiar, not only in the entire entertainment landscape, but also very clearly in the political landscape as well.
And you talk about what sociologists call sorting and socializing. So people We seek out others who are like us, right? We sort to get into those groups. And then we also, we change to become more of a group that we want to become or that we want to get in, and that's called socializing. So I wonder, there's this theory that Mr. Trump was, you know, speaking to these forgotten frustrations of largely middle American and middle-aged white men and many white women as well, and people were relating to that. You talk about how with apps, the new apps that come out, the ones that are the most popular are various iterations of self-expression. What about the importance of identifying personally with, in the case of Mr. Trump, a political candidate, or in the case of, you know, sort of political philosophy, or even just the products that we buy, somehow seeing ourselves in them?
Yeah, it's actually a really interesting connection that I hadn't made, to be quite honest. That Trump is a great example of socialization, in that he was famous enough and rich enough to not care too much about his political prospects, and as a result, he had what I suppose a conservative might call the courage, or at least the cojones might be the more appropriate term, to speak his mind. A lot of people liked that he seemed to speak his mind. Even when he was clearly lying, they still appreciated a kind of performative authenticity, particularly when he talked about immigration and about cultural issues. So yeah, I think you could say that a really important part of Trump's appeal is the fact that a lot of people felt that he was willing to say things that other people were too afraid to say. He was willing to speak to the inner truths the inner feelings of cultural conservatism that other people were a little bit too hesitant to give voice to. I do think that there is an element of that to Trump. I also think we should just, you know, say very, very clearly that throughout cultural history, scandal has played an enormous role in accidentally popularizing both good and bad ideas. The way that Impressionism broke through into the mainstream of art was through incredible scandal in the 1890s when the first Impressionist paintings were hung in the Musée de Luxembourg, the French State Museum. The way that a lot of these painters became famous, Monet and Manet and Cézanne, was because they were such scandals in the 1890s. The same thing happened with rock and roll in the 1950s. Rock and roll was considered unbelievably dangerous for teenagers to be listening to, and it was precisely that danger, that perceived scandalous danger, that made younger people want to listen to it. And I am in no qualitative way equating Donald Trump with Monet and Elvis Presley here, but I do think that there is something to the fact that Trump's ability to merchandise scandal, to be essentially a factory for scandalous events and quotes, makes it impossible for the media and for his supporters to stop paying attention to him. And that ability to understand the attention-grabbing and attention-concentrating nature of scandal is, love him or hate him, truly one of Trump's talents.
Derek Thompson's new book is called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. It's just out in paperback. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a flash. 3 o'clock, 4 Stay o'clock, with us.
Rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me, hon. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Very glad to be joined by Derek Thompson. He's the author of Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Mr. Thompson notes in his book that it took the telephone almost 40 years to become an indispensable device in American homes, the road from niche to mainstream was much quicker for things like cars and radios, cell phones, the internet. That was less than 10 years. So we are talking today about the driving forces behind cultural trends. How does a mediocre song or a one-minute home video become an international hit or a viral sensation, generating millions of downloads and views? So what's the science? Is there a science behind trends? And how do marketing firms harness the power of cultural capital to entice us to ingest copious amounts of music and media and film and tech? Derek Thompson joins us from the studios of NPR in New York. He is a senior editor at Atlantic Magazine. Let's talk a little bit about movies. You mentioned that, for example, Star Wars, and again, this goes back to this balance between familiarity and new. Perhaps Star Wars is as popular as it is because nothing like it had ever happened before it, or it's as popular as it is because there are so many dimensions of it that are incredibly familiar. What do you mean by all that?
Sure. You know, Star Wars is, without question, not only the best-selling movie of all time individually, Episode 4, but also the most popular movie franchise of all time. It's a towering achievement. But when George Lucas was writing Star Wars in the 1960s, 1970s, the first few drafts were absolutely terrible. All of his friends told him so. Francis Ford Coppola was like, this is like completely indecipherable. It's awful. He had built essentially this beautiful, weird, complex, novel world, but there was no story to guide him through it. And George Lucas was sort of struggling to figure out what story exactly he should tell. And then he stumbled upon Joseph Campbell, a sociologist, a mythologist, who had this theory that there's basically only one story in the world. It's the hero's journey. It's the story of a young man, often a man rather than a woman, a young man who's lost, who is offered the opportunity to go on an incredible quest, initially turns it down, but finally assents and says, all right, I'll go on this quest, overcomes all of these sort of spiritual obstacles, finally meets a figure, a nemesis, who is intimately involved in his own origin story, defeats that nemesis, and then returns to the real world, to the natural, ordinary world, as a hero. And this is the story, if you can recognize it, not only of, say, you know, Beowulf and Jesus, but also of Harry Potter and The Lord of the Rings and, of course, Star Wars. And George Lucas realized that all he had to do was marry this incredibly surprising world-building exercise with the most familiar story in the world, and that would be a hit. And it was precisely, I think, because the story of Star Wars felt so familiar that we could focus on all of the extraordinary achievements of his creativity. And so in that way, I think Star Wars is the perfect example of how if you're out there and you're struggling with this idea and struggling with how to make this idea popular and appealing, and it's really a brave, new, weird idea, then your challenge is, how do I make the surprising familiar? How do I find a familiar way to make audiences or consumers see the old story within this new vision?
And sometimes it's a matter of scale to make things as big as they are. You talk about, for example, in the 1950s, the average number of movie tickets that Americans bought were about 25. And in 2015, it's 4. You know, so
yeah.
you think, well, if you're going to make something that's huge, you know, maybe movies isn't the way to do it. But Star Wars, you know, speaks to the opposite, the opposite side of that coin. And you also talk about folks who try to figure this out, folks like you who try to figure this out, you know, try to look for those commonalities between all things that are popular. You know, why 50 Shades of Grey and Star Wars and these, you know, Yanny and Laurel or whatever. You know, what makes it popular? Or they either do that or they go back to like patient zero. You know, who's the first person who figured this out or who started this thing moving? And what are the characteristics of that human being, that woman or that man? I wonder, where does that leave so-called influencers. You know, we hear about these people that companies hire. They're mostly young. They're extremely hip. They're extremely tuned in. And they are the ones that if they are seen wearing the shoes, or they're seen eating at the restaurant, or they are heard remarking about a cool new book or a cool new song, it's gonna spur a lot of interest and buzz. But is the influencer still on the rise in our culture, or is even the moment for the influencer lost given the various many other dimensions that go into this?
Yeah, I do want to talk about influencers. But actually, I really want to talk about Laurel and Yanny, if that's all right with you.
And by the way, I'm a Yanny. How about you?
I'm a Laurel. You're completely wrong.
Yeah.
But this is exactly why it's fascinating. And so I have a chapter toward the end of the book called The Audience of My Audience. And that's a chapter essentially about how consumers talk to each other and how we socialize and sort, as you said earlier. There's an idea, however, in that chapter that if I had another swing at the book, I might turn into half of the book, because the more I think about it, the more interesting it feels to me. And that is the idea of cults. Now, the sociological definition of a cult is a group of people who unite around the idea that the mainstream is wrong and illegitimate, and they can make a positive rebellion against it. And in so many ways, I think we reserve the word cult for ideas that are way outside of the cultural mainstream. But in fact, culture itself is just the agglomeration of cults. Culture is cults all the way down. We want to sort ourselves into cults. And what possible story could better explain this than the phenomenon of a dictionary.com reading of the word Laurel dividing the entire country while ironically uniting them in a single blockbuster cultural experience? We love these sort of what color is the dress, is it Laurel or is it Yanny style questions, because they allow us to sort ourselves. They give us the ability to say, I'm a Laurel, you're a Yanny. I'm right, you're wrong. We are on different teams, and we can fight about the differences, but also be united in the conversation about who's right. This is exactly why sports is so popular. You know, in many ways, I have lots of friends who are like, sports is so dumb. I don't understand basketball. I hate football. Baseball is so incredibly boring. How can sports possibly be interesting to people? And the answer is that sports is the one way that people are allowed to cultify themselves in a mainstream manner. It doesn't make any sense to wear the laundry of a certain team or club from thousands of miles away and say, this is me, this is my identity. No matter who is on the team, no matter who owns it.
And actually, Derek, let me interrupt you because we have a caller on the line, Phil in Baltimore, who I think wants to make a very similar point. Phil, your quick point for Derek Thompson.
Yes, hello, Mr. Thompson. You're stealing my thunder there. I was calling in to mention how so many times after a baseball team wins a World Series or a football team wins the Super Bowl, not even fans in those cities buy T-shirts and hats, but many people around the country in other cities that are probably more usually loyal to other teams, they still like to be seen with a winner. You understand what I mean?
Of course, that concept.
That's a really good point, Phil. And you know, again, is this the kind of cart before the horse thing, Derek? Where if something is popular, people jump on, or you know, it's obviously takes a certain concentration, a certain mass to make things popular. But then after that, it can expand exponentially a little quicker, I guess.
Yeah, so it's funny. I wrote a column for the Atlantic magazine in the last issue that was literally a defense of bandwagoning and being a fair weather fan for sports teams. So that's an entirely different conversation that lots of people have gotten mad at me about. But I will simply say to the caller, of course we should gravitate to successful teams rather than unsuccessful teams. Sports is entertainment. And we gravitate toward popularity, or at least most of us gravitate toward popularity, in every other sector of entertainment. We tend to listen to music that is popular more than we listen to music that's unpopular. We tend to be more intrigued by movies that have good critical reception scores on Rotten Tomatoes and have already scored well at the box office. Popularity isn't just an outcome of a product's quality. It's also a signal. Popularity is a signal. It says, this is safe. This is good. This is worth your time. It's not the best signal. It's not the most important signal, but it's a really clear signal. So, of course, you should expect that signal to work not only in music and movies, but also in sports.
Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine, where he covers politics, economics, and media. Mr. Thompson also hosts a podcast for The Atlantic called Crazy Genius. His book is called Hitmakers: The Science of Popularity in the Age of Distraction. We spoke last May. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a conversation with the most celebrated First Amendment lawyer of our time. Floyd Abrams joins me to talk about his most recent book, The Soul of the First Amendment. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.